proclaim McCarthy a very bad man, just so liberals will leave them alone. The casual association of McCarthy with Hollywood blacklisting demonstrates the left's renowned respect for the truth. McCarthy's non-existent crusade has become a fact by sheer repetition. With no explanation, a 2002 New York Times article on the movie industry listed McCarthyism as among the various plagues and scourges that had beset the industry. Honorable though it was, the Hollywood blacklisting had nothing to do with McCarthy. The Hollywood Ten were called before HUAC in 1947. To repeat, McCarthy was never in the House. In 1947, he had just been elected to the Senate and was so little known that the New York Times called him a moderate Republican. Even Hiss had been exposed, indicted, and convicted before McCarthy took up the anti-communist cause in his 1950 speech in Wheeling, West Virginia. McCarthy never participated in any investigation of Hollywood. To be sure, the Hollywood blacklisting was truly heart-wrenching. While people were being forced to eat their shoes in the Ukraine, only a heart of stone could fail to be moved by the stories of Hollywood screenwriters who couldn't sell a Twilight Zone episode for up to 3 years. There are dark tales of writers whose names did not run in the credits for MASH. Some of the persecuted were even forced to flee to Paris and spin their semi-pornographic essays from the Champs-Élysées. Such suffering is endlessly recounted in lachrymose memoirs, movies, documentaries, museum exhibits, and award ceremonies celebrating the blacklist survivors. Claiming to have been blacklisted is Hollywood's version of the Mayflower. Sometimes their bragging gets the better of them, and the survivors forget to include the part about how hard it was. Blacklist survivor Norma Barsman describes her life in exile in Paris thus. "We had dinner with Picasso every Tuesday night when we were at our country house in Provence. Yves Montand and Simon Signoret, Jacques Privé were all friends. Plus, we got to work with all the amazing European directors. It was hard, but it was also the time of my life." Meanwhile, back in the country they preferred, the USSR, people were being whisked off to Soviet gulags in the dead of night. They were being sentenced to work in forced labor camps. They were sent to Siberia for 5 years. They were being shot execution style after being forced to confess to absurd diabolical conspiracies. 10 Hollywood scribblers who subscribed to an ideology responsible for murder by the million refused to admit their membership in the Communist Party to a House committee. All they had to do was fess up, but they felt they had a right not to tell the truth, so they were briefly jailed for contempt. This created a slight setback in their dinners with Picasso. The horror. Clearly, it wasn't the indignity of testifying before a House committee that tried their troubled souls. Once the atrocity of having to tell the truth about being communists had passed, actors and actresses began leaping at the chance to appear before congressional committees. When Democrats controlled Congress in the 80s, you couldn't turn on C-SPAN without being subjected to the spectacle of some movie star eagerly testifying about disease, childhood obesity, Alar on apples, circus elephants, or the plight of farmers. Indeed, a Democratic-controlled House Agriculture Committee once held a hearing on farmers in which not a single farmer testified. But millionaire actresses who had played farmers' wives in movies such as Jane Fonda, Jessica Lange, and Sissy Spacek had a lot to say on the subject. Nor, evidently, does the concept of blacklisting offend liberals' sense of fair play. How are the job opportunities these days for screenwriters who believe homosexuality is wrong? Would an actress who is anti-choice have an easy time finding work? In 1998, the American Film Institute and the Los Angeles Film Critics Association refused to grant Ilya Kazan a Lifetime Achievement Award because he cooperated with HUAC's investigation of communists in Hollywood. Kazan discovered James Dean and Marlon Brando. He had won 3 Oscars and directed such movies as A Streetcar Named Desire and On the Waterfront. That same year, Cinecon, a national film organization dedicated to old and silent films, gave its annual Film Achievement Award to Leni Riefenstahl, the Nazi filmmaker most famous for her 1934 film celebrating Hitler, The Triumph of the Will. Hollywood's commitment to freedom and civil liberties has always been a one-way ratchet, protecting only the admirers of communist totalitarians. It is no surprise that the fear of McCarthyism comes from Hollywood. Only the movie industry could produce that level of womanly hysteria. Hollywood drama queens told deranged lies about their torment and their guilt while adults tried to hold hearings into a serious matter. Whitaker Chambers said of HUAC, "I watched the committee's members behave with conspicuous patience and composure in the face of repeated, insolent provocation that no body of men in civil life would have endured." Indeed, the frothing ideological rants of the Hollywood Ten drove away such stars as Humphrey Bogart, Lauren Bacall, Danny Kaye, and Gene Kelly, who had flown to Washington to support, as they thought, free speech. Not realizing free speech was a fig leaf for communism, John Garfield genially proposed, "Why doesn't Congress make it illegal to belong to the Communist Party and clear the whole thing up?" After one day of watching John Howard Lawson rant at the committee, screaming that the congressmen were Nazis, predicting concentration camps in America, and generally sounding like Pravda before having to be physically dragged away, the Hollywood delegation left, humiliated. Bogart later called the trip to Washington ill-advised, even foolish. Bacall said, "We were so naive, it was ridiculous." Unlike the legal proceedings of their hero, Joseph Stalin, the drama queens were granted full due process and legal representation. Apparently on orders from Stalin, as Michael Ybarra reports in The New Republic, the Hollywood Ten refused to answer the committee's questions. Preposterously, they claimed a First Amendment right not to answer questions pursuant to a subpoena. This would be like a robber claiming a First Amendment right to, say, your money or your life. It was so absurd, the Supreme Court refused to hear the case, and the Ten went to jail for contempt. All had the benefit of legal counsel, trial by jury, and proof beyond a reasonable doubt standards. Still, the cosseted, over-pampered Hollywood elites were shocked to discover they could be held responsible for anything they do, and the rest of the country would never hear the end of it. At about the same time, under the legal system communists revered, Stalin executed, starved, exiled, or imprisoned over 10 million people. Yet in accounts of the period, Stalin is treated as an irrelevant distraction from the real threat to freedom, which was McCarthyism. One of Stalin's most starstruck admirers, Lillian Hellman, wrote the book Scoundrel Time, describing her heroism in standing up to McCarthyism. Hellman's script for the pro-Soviet Hollywood movie The North Star defended Stalin throughout the Hitler-Stalin Pact, through the purges, through the forced starvation. But McCarthy got her goat. Needless to say, McCarthy had absolutely nothing to do with Hellman. Hellman had been called to testify before HUAC. Remember what the H stands for. This innocent victim of McCarthyism, whom McCarthy never noticed, bequeathed profits from her book to a fund for the advancement of the doctrines of Karl Marx. Owen Lattimore, poor beleaguered victim of McCarthyism, hailed Stalin's murderous show trials as the sort of habitual rectification that would encourage others to tell the truth. As he put it, "That sounds like democracy to me." Russia was awash in the blood of this Fellini-esque hoax, but Lattimore gushed with admiration. From his hideout in Mexico, Trotsky denounced the show trials as a frame-up, saying the confessions contained such inherent improbabilities as to convince any unprejudiced person that no effort was made to ascertain the truth. American liberals were evidently not the unprejudiced witnesses Trotsky had hoped for. While tens of millions were being executed, torn from their families, subjected to forced starvations as a matter of government policy, packed on trains and sent to Siberian gulags in the glorious USSR, about 200 people in America were blacklisted from a single frivolous industry. They could still go to Paris or sell real estate or do any number of things. They just couldn't work in the movies. That was the only price they paid for shilling for a mass murderer. McCarthy's real victims were not sympathetic witnesses, frivolous Hollywood screenwriters, or irrelevant blowhard college professors. They were elite WASP establishment policymakers. Sedition always held a strange attraction for Ivy League types with three names, like John Stuart Service, Harry Dexter White, George Catlett Marshall, and William Sloan Coffin. It was a quirky thing about WASPs. They took perverse pride in harboring the periodic traitor. Their reaction to Alger Hiss was the concentrated expression of that sentiment. Even John Foster Dulles and Dwight Eisenhower had defended Hiss. Eisenhower was better than any Democrat, but he was part of the elite establishment. They all liked each other, these Anglophile blue bloods. They went to Yale, played cricket, became Rhodes Scholars, wrestled in the mud together at the Skull and Bone Society, and went to parties where Dean Acheson was invariably a guest. They were well-born and looked good in dinner jackets. Protecting traitors was part of the bonhomie of the ruling class. George Catlett Marshall was the prime example of the ruling elite's exasperating self-satisfaction. Marshall had been a superb military leader in World War II, principally by choosing General Dwight Eisenhower to lead the Allied forces. But Marshall went on to serve President Truman in various capacities, including as ambassador to China, Secretary of State, and Secretary of Defense. And as a policymaker, Marshall was an unmitigated disaster. He supported enormous concessions to Stalin at Yalta, including turning over Poland to the USSR. He helped consign 1 billion people to a totalitarian dungeon in China. He played a central role in Truman's firing General Douglas MacArthur. One has only to observe the veneration of Marshall on the PBS webpage to realize that his civilian career was not all sunshine and song. There was rarely as incompetent a figure as Marshall, but the Blue Bloods brooked no criticism of their boy. When McCarthy attacked Marshall, the establishment reacted with sputtering rage. Contrary to popular mythology, McCarthy never called Marshall a traitor, a communist, or a coward. He simply detailed Marshall's record for 3 hours one day on the Senate floor, with facts, dates, and names. Even McCarthy haters admitted that his case against Marshall was based on a laboriously assembled record. Marshall had been implacably blind to the intentions of Mao's communists. He doggedly refused to believe Mao was anything other than a simple agrarian reformer. An OSS officer desperately tried to warn Marshall that Mao was a Marxist, but Marshall was too busy putting the final touches on his bow tie for a fancy dinner party to listen. When Mao's second-in-command, Zhou Enlai, left a notebook on Marshall's private plane containing the names of Maoist spies who had infiltrated the nationalist Chinese government, Marshall ordered his underling to return the notebook without even taking a little peek. Marshall's work in losing China to communism was so impressive, he even won the Nobel Peace Prize for it. Though his name adorns the Marshall Plan, it is a fact that George Marshall opposed the whole point of the plan. The Marshall Plan is rightly hailed as a crucial element in preventing a Soviet takeover of all of Europe. The United States poured billions of dollars into Western Europe to jumpstart their war-torn economies. By allowing non-communist European nations to flourish, the Marshall Plan strengthened Western Europe and immunized it from the allures of Soviet communism. This precise virtue of the Marshall Plan was opposed by one George Marshall. Marshall never envisioned the plan as a weapon in the Cold War at all, but rather a pointless do-gooder welfare scheme for the world at large. In a proposal of stunning stupidity, Marshall wanted to include the Soviet Union and its satellite states in the Marshall Plan. The Marshall Plan is now cited by liberals as a brilliant democratic stratagem against the Soviet Union. It was, but only despite Truman and Marshall. Fortunately, the actual Marshall Plan bore very little relation to what Marshall had proposed. The Republicans modified the Marshall Plan submitted by Truman in another way. Congress included $500 million in aid to nationalist China and additional military aid to Greece and Turkey. Truman had requested no aid for nationalist China whatsoever. Prescient little fellow that he was, Truman could already see that China would be lost and no one could be accused of losing it. McCarthy was not the only Republican to attack Marshall, but he was the most penetrating. In an erudite 60,000-word speech that was later turned into a book titled America's Retreat from Victory, McCarthy recited chapter and verse of Marshall's disastrous policy decisions. He began by saying, "I realize full well how unpopular it is to lay hands on the laurels of a man who has been built into a great hero. I very much dislike it, but I feel that it must be done if we are to intelligently make the proper decisions in the issues of life and death before us." After detailing Marshall's stunning naivete towards Stalin and Mao, McCarthy made a remark that stung the entire liberal establishment. If Marshall was merely stupid, the laws of probability would dictate that part of his decisions would serve America's interests. Liberals were aghast. Just because millions of people kept being enslaved as a direct result of their policies, it was no reason to get snippy. As was usually the case with anyone McCarthy attacked, Marshall was subjected to undeserved praise and liberal emoluments for the rest of his life. No discussion of the victims of McCarthyism is complete without mentioning McCarthy's biggest star, Owen Lattimore. Joining a long list, Lattimore boasted that it was he who coined the word McCarthyism. Lattimore came to McCarthy's attention after he was named by a former communist as a Soviet agent. For many years, Louis Boudens had been a leader in the Communist Party USA, an editor of the Daily Worker. Other Soviet agents named by Boudens were confirmed by the Venona Project. Among those he identified as a Soviet spy was Owen Lattimore. Somewhat surprisingly, Lattimore's name has not yet turned up in the Venona cables as a Soviet agent. This glaring oversight can only be attributed to the limited number of cables that have been decoded. As the saying goes, if Lattimore wasn't being paid by Moscow, he was being gypped. Lattimore's friends were Soviet spies. His employees were Soviet spies. His associates were Soviet spies. He was hand-picked by a Soviet spy on Roosevelt's staff to advise Chiang Kai-shek. Thanks to Lattimore's learned counsel, U.S. policymakers abandoned Chiang Kai-shek and supported Mao Zedong, the greatest mass murderer in history. When he was called before two Senate committees in the early 50s, Lattimore's first line of defense to McCarthy's charges was to indignantly deny ever having worked for the government. Evidence tending to contradict Lattimore's denial that he was mixed up with the State Department included the facts that he used an office at the State Department, he took phone calls at the State Department, and he answered mail addressed to Lachlan Curry at the State Department. Curry was a top White House official and also a Soviet agent, proved by Venona. As White House liaison to the State Department, his office was in the State Department building. In a letter dated June 12, 1942, Lattimore informed an acquaintance, "I am in Washington about 4 days a week, and when there, can always be reached at Lachlan Curry's office, room 228, State Department building." Lattimore was eventually indicted on 7 counts of perjury. Despite the New York Times' ardent desire, occasionally printed as fact, Lattimore was never acquitted of the perjury charges. The charges against him were dismissed on technical grounds. Liberals treated Lattimore like some sort of abstract intellectual, practically a poet, with no interest in politics whatsoever. To say Lattimore had no effect on America's China policy because he was not a permanent employee of the State Department would be like saying Dick Morris had no effect on Clinton's campaign strategy because he was not on the White House payroll. To be sure, Morris never drew green U.S. Treasury checks, but he was a close advisor to those who did. Lattimore actually was on the U.S. payroll, drawing paychecks from both the Office of War Information and the State Department as a member of the State Department's Pauley Commission to Japan. To this day, liberals deny that Lattimore had any connection to the State Department, as if by refusing to admit something, they can prevent it from being true. The left's poet laureate Lattimore was hauled out of irrelevance by President Roosevelt on the recommendation of Soviet agent Curry, and sent to advise Chiang Kai-shek from 1941 to 1942. He also accompanied Vice President Henry Wallace on his trip to Siberia and China in 1944. After Lattimore toured Stalin's slave labor camps with Wallace, he gushed about the wonderful things Stalin was doing for Russia. Using the standard liberal talking point about Soviet slave labor camps, Lattimore described the gulags as a combination Hudson Bay Company and Tennessee Valley Authority. Stalin's other Manchurian candidate, Henry Wallace, used the exact same phrase. By the time McCarthy called Lattimore a Soviet spy, 46 people associated with Lattimore's institute had been named under oath as members of the Communist Party, and 8 others as espionage agents for the Soviet Union. That's even more than the New York Times had. Lattimore's entire institute was chock full of Soviet spies. In a fawning profile of Lattimore in the Washington Post in 1995, Orville Schell wrote that Lattimore's institute was attacked for reasons that are still mysterious. Bear with me here, this is just a guess, but maybe it was the 8 Soviet spies working there. Schell described critics of Lattimore's institute as pesky yet irrelevant cranks with a single-minded agenda. Their pesky, single-minded agenda was keeping a quarter of humanity free. This countercurrent in intellectual opinion, as Shell put it, viewed the old China hands, Lattimore and his ilk, as being soft on communism. By opposing Chiang and supporting Mao, was Lattimore being tough on communism? Owen Lattimore was the original Clinton. He stonewalled the truth and liberals would never apologize. Conservatives go through agonies of conscience for 30 years after quickly admitting to some minor misstatement. Democrats tolerated the patent risk of allowing Soviet partisans to loiter around their administrations, and to this day they will not admit the truth. The left's idea of persecution is an absence of total unanimity in support of Harvard-educated traitors. Lattimore said McCarthy was a fool or a knave if he imagined Lattimore had promoted communist interests on the flimsy evidence of his having promoted communist interests. Furthermore, McCarthy had created a reign of terror. Most devastatingly, Lattimore said McCarthy had made America the laughingstock of the communist governments, a terrifying prospect to liberals everywhere. Lattimore's harangue was recently described in the Washington Post as eloquent and convincing. The terrified and quaking Lattimore called his accusers a motley crew of crackpots, professional informers, hysterics, and ex-communists, embittered, ruthless, and unprincipled, masters of the dark techniques of villainy, and artists of conspiracy. Particularly terrifying, evidently, was McCarthy himself, whom Lattimore shrunk from in fear by calling him a string of names such as the Wisconsin Whimperer and a graduate witch burner. One wonders what turns of phrase he would have used if McCarthy had been a little less intimidating. Yes, McCarthy held a terrified nation hostage. Lattimore was defended pro bono by future Supreme Court Justice Abe Fortas and Yale Law School professor John Frank. President Truman, fresh from denouncing the Hiss hearings as a red herring, said Lattimore was being shamefully persecuted by the Senate. All in all, Lattimore's persecution would not be matched until President Clinton's ordeal in the Black Night of Fascism ignited by a man called Ken Starr. Though Lattimore prattled on about my seriously damaged reputation, his stock only soared in the nation's editorial pages and universities. The idea of a bowed and terrified liberal minority during McCarthy's reign of terror is poppycock. Then as now, all elite opinion was against McCarthy. The principal result of being called a communist by McCarthy was you got to teach at Harvard. Lattimore's descent into the hell of McCarthyism involved fawning media coverage, legal representation by a future Supreme Court justice, a paid leave from Johns Hopkins, annual lectures at Harvard, and the adulation of academics everywhere. Having survived his ordeal, Lattimore took a position at the University of Leeds in Britain. Only by incremental slander did the loud-mouthed victims of McCarthyism finally convince people that McCarthy held a terrified nation captive. Never has a more powerful oligarchy screamed so long and so loudly about its own victimization. Chapter 6. But were there communists in the State Department? History is an endless process of liberal brainwashing. The battle for truth is purely propagandistic. Liberals can't persuade, they can only harumph. But they write the history books. Like all historical myths, arrogant and powerful institutions of liberalism distorted the truth about McCarthy through sheer malice. He was subjected to a relentless stream of abuse, the likes of which would not be seen again until Ken Starr had the goods on Clinton. Liberal hysteria has become historical fact. History textbooks ritualistically include the demonstrably false assertion that McCarthy did not discover a single communist anywhere. Schoolchildren are taught in a major American textbook, History of Us, that McCarthy, quote, was a liar, not your ordinary small-time fibber. No, Senator Joseph McCarthy was an enormous, outrageous, beyond belief liar. Upcoming editions will include the dark tale of how Swedes flew planes into the World Trade Center, and glorious renditions of how Bill Clinton, shoulder to shoulder with Larry Flint, saved the Constitution. Flip through any book about McCarthy and notice the footnotes. It is an arresting fact that the supporting documentation rarely consists of primary source material. Academics cite other academics, who cite other academics, with nearly all statements about McCarthy eventually tracing their way back to contemporaneous news accounts from a rapidly anti-McCarthy press. Doing original research on McCarthy is apparently not tenure-track material at American universities. As the saying goes, the first draft of history is written by journalists, and we know who they are. They told us Clinton was only counseling Monica, but trust them on McCarthy. The news industry is the last place you'd go for the truth about McCarthy. It would be as if all historical accounts of the Bush presidency were based exclusively on Maureen Dowd columns. The press loathed McCarthy. Their idea of investigative reporting was to recycle passages from the Tidings Committee report, a well-known smear job hatched by the segregationist, Soviet sympathizer, McCarthy adversary Millard Tidings. Tidings' father-in-law was the infamous Joseph Davies, Roosevelt's ambassador to the USSR, who gushed with admiration for Stalin's show trials, later made into a major motion picture, Mission to Moscow. Historical facts about McCarthy are sourced to the news stories of prominent journalists like I.F. Stone. The late Fred Friendly, doyen of American journalism, called Stone the conscience of investigative journalism. So honest was I.F. Stone that an Oliphant cartoon showed him refusing to enter heaven because, as St. Peter is telling God, he'd rather hang around out here and keep things honest. Needless to say, Stone attacked McCarthy early and often. He was an idealist. He supported Joseph Stalin in the 30s, the Soviet-backed Progressive Party, presidential candidate Henry Wallace in the 40s, and Ho Chi Minh in the 60s. He spoke at the first Vietnam teach-in at Berkeley. 2 years later, he marched on the Pentagon. Despite the serious risk of being called brave, Stone stood with the New York Times, the Washington Post, CBS, NBC, ABC, Hollywood, and every college and university in the nation against the brute McCarthy. The Los Angeles Times hailed Stone's raw courage, saying, long before it was safe to do so, he attacked McCarthyite loyalty purges. One can only imagine the horror that would befall a journalist who criticized McCarthy. In fact, literally one can only imagine it. It has now been overwhelmingly documented that I.F. Stone was a paid Soviet agent. While intrepidly attacking McCarthy, this conscience of investigative journalism was on the payroll of a totalitarian regime. Stone was identified as an agent by a former KGB agent in 1992. A few years after that, declassified Soviet cables confirmed that he was an agent. In one cable, Stone's Soviet contact reported Stone was willing to accept money for his services, but did not want to attract the attention of the FBI. An American journalist on Joseph Stalin's payroll was indistinguishable from other members of his profession. Stone was constantly cited as an exemplar of honest and independent journalism. The tough-minded individualist and Soviet spy published hysterical diatribes against McCarthy. Without a fig leaf of evidence, Stone called McCarthy an anti-Semite, and for good measure, a fascist. It was standard Communist Party strategy to throw out baseless accusations of anti-Semitism and fascism. In his book Radical Son, David Horowitz explains that the Communist Party played up the Jewish issue whenever it could, in order to make comparisons with Nazi Germany seem plausible. Historian Ronald Radosh says, the tarring of opponents with the fascist brush was the favored course of attack used by American communists and their supporters. As red diaper babies, Horowitz and Radosh sat at communist dinner tables and heard them speak freely, never suspecting they would be ratted out. In order to appreciate how the myth of McCarthyism was concocted, consider how liberals portray events happening right before our eyes. Only those fresh in the struggle can see how the left's obfuscatory techniques operate. According to the guardians of the McCarthy myth, the most recent efflorescence of McCarthyism was the grim zealot Starr persecuting Bill Clinton for no reason whatsoever. People who assure us McCarthy presided over a reign of terror also describe Ken Starr's plotting, meticulous investigation as a reign of terror. And they say that when we're watching. Imagine what they'll say when the generation that knows the truth is gone. The image of McCarthy riding roughshod over civil liberties and terrifying small children is difficult to square with the fact that the public loved him. Even without the truth monitor of the internet and Fox News Channel, At the time, people could see McCarthy for themselves. In the words of historian David Oshinsky, McCarthy's campaign was alarmingly popular. The more he railed against communists working for the government, the higher his approval rating soared. At the height of the left's counterattack against McCarthy, just months away from a Senate censure, Americans told pollsters they approved the job he was doing by 50 to 29%. Excluding those who had no opinion, his approval rating was 63%. Bobby Kennedy worked for McCarthy and held him in such high esteem that he asked McCarthy to be the godfather to his first child, Kathleen Kennedy Townsend, born on the 4th of July, 1951. This was 17 months after McCarthy's famous Wheeling, West Virginia speech, well into McCarthy's reign of terror. The very year of McCarthy's censure, John F. Kennedy fiercely defended McCarthy on Soviet territory, Cambridge, Massachusetts. In response to a speaker's lighthearted remark that, unlike the law school, Harvard College could be proud of never having produced either an Alger Hiss or a Joe McCarthy, Kennedy erupted. "How dare you couple the name of a great American patriot with that of a traitor?" Kennedy would schedule long-needed surgery in order to avoid having to vote on McCarthy's censure, a vote that was taken largely on partisan lines. Mortified by the Kennedy family's manifest admiration for McCarthy, liberals are always recalling some late-night conversation no one else heard, in which the Kennedys expressed their secret qualms about McCarthy. The facts speak for themselves. That McCarthy was on to something is evident in the fact that almost everyone knows he was a wretched man, this country's rough equivalent of Stalin, arguably even as bad as Ken Starr. But almost no one knows if he was right. This is the follow-up question that's never asked. That's not the point. Rather, liberals explained that McCarthy was a drunk and a demagogue who played poker for money, shocking the consciences of sissy boys in academia. But were there communist spies working for the U.S. government? Moreover, McCarthy's office may have pulled strings to get former staffer David Shine special privileges from the Army. But were communists working for the U.S. government? McCarthy's staff attorney, Roy Cohn, was gay. But were communists working for the U.S. government? McCarthy slightly embellished upon his World War II exploits, but not as much as liberals exaggerated his exaggerations. But were communist spies working for the U.S. government? In addition, McCarthy may have said he had a list of 205 communists in the State Department rather than 57, as he later claimed. But were communist spies working for the U.S. government? McCarthy was actually accused of perjury for denying he had said he had the names of 205 communists in the State Department in his Wheeling, West Virginia speech. McCarthy plausibly insisted he had claimed to have the names of only 57 communists. The 205 figure was an important number, but it referred to something else. Just a few years earlier, the Democratic Secretary of State, James Burns, had admitted that 205 identified security risks at the State Department were still on the job. No one seemed to know what had happened to those identified security risks, which was precisely McCarthy's point. He certainly didn't claim to have a list of their names. To the contrary, he was enraged that no one else did either. The possibility that hundreds of security risks were still employed by the State Department did not interest the Democrats. They just wanted to know whether McCarthy had claimed to have the names of 205 or 57 communists at the State Department. To put this controversy in perspective, only weeks before McCarthy's speech, Alger Hiss had been convicted of perjury for lying about being a Soviet spy. Stalinist spies were passing secret government files to Soviet agents, and the treason party sprang to action by vigorously investigating the precise words McCarthy had used in a speech to a women's Republican club in West Virginia. This from the legally accurate crowd. Bill Clinton denied under oath that he had engaged in sexual relations with Monica Lewinsky, or even that he was ever alone with Monica Lewinsky. This is hailed as Clinton's courageous effort to save the Constitution. But long gaseous books have attempted to prove McCarthy said he had the names of 205 communists rather than 57 communists. A congressional committee set to work investigating the pressing issue of whether McCarthy had said he had the names of 205 or 57 communists. Liberals could never manage to produce a tape of his alleged offense, but the committee did produce affidavits from journalists who, a little too eagerly, signed affidavits contradicting McCarthy. Even the investigating committee found the journalists' affidavits unbelievable and dismissed them as unreliable. The committee report grudgingly concluded that McCarthy had probably claimed to have the names of 57 communists, just as he had always said. One will search history books in vain for any mention of the committee's conclusion as to McCarthy's capital offense of misspeaking. This part of the report mysteriously disappeared immediately after it was released and was instantly forgotten. All credible evidence on the subject supports McCarthy. But to this day, history books universally assert that McCarthy said 205 rather than 57, and then indignantly accuse McCarthy of being sloppy with his facts. McCarthy initially named only about 100 loyalty risks in government jobs. Not necessarily spies or even members of the Communist Party, just people who shouldn't be working for the U.S. government. As we now know, he was erring on the low side. So far, and the review is not complete, decrypted Soviet cables have revealed well over 300 Soviet spies working for the government in the 40s and 50s. Hundreds of agents of an enemy foreign power were working for the U.S. government. But McCarthy was a brute for pointing it out. The primary victim of outrageous persecution during the McCarthy era was McCarthy. Liberals hid their traitorous conduct by making McCarthy the issue. They did to McCarthy everything they falsely accuse him of doing to them. The press didn't mind trafficking in innuendo and smears when McCarthy was the target. Only when communist spies and sympathizers were exposed did it qualify as a witch hunt. There was much liberal hilarity over the fact that McCarthy and two of his assistants, Roy Cohn and David Schein, were at one time all unmarried men. The liberal playwright Lillian Hellman giddily gay-baited them as Bonnie, Bonnie, and Clyde. Hank Greenspun, publisher of the Las Vegas Sun, called McCarthy a disreputable pervert. McCarthy, who would soon be married, laughed off the taunts. In a final payback, the New York Times took the occasion of Roy Cohn's death to out him as a homosexual. The obituary referred to widespread rumors that Cohn was gay. Cohn was unavailable for comment. Senator William Benton issued a report on McCarthy so scurrilous that Benton's own lawyer called it the most libelous document he had ever seen. Page after page of Benton's diatribe repeated unsubstantiated gossip and outright lies. Benton falsely accused McCarthy of bribe-taking. It called him amoral and said he was of unsound mind. It denounced McCarthy for having an admitted homosexual ex-communist on his payroll. It cited as hard fact the lies of a delusional nut who claimed to be an international spy working for McCarthy. In an egregious violation of McCarthy's privacy, Benton's committee directed the Washington Postmaster to keep a record of every piece of mail sent to McCarthy's home and the homes of his top assistants. To get other senators' signatures on his report, Benton preyed on the alcoholism of two members of the subcommittee. Muckraking journalist Drew Pearson, the Larry Flint of his day, threatened to expose one as an alcoholic unless he signed Benton's report. The other senator had to be plied with alcohol before putting his name on the report, a report he later dismissed as without legal authority. The press was whipped into a frenzy of hysteria over Benton's baseless charges. Media across the nation recklessly repeated large sections of the report. The New York Post ran a sensationalized 17-part series on the charges. McCarthy sued one of the newspapers that printed the absurd charge that he had funded spies abroad. He won a public apology and $12,000 in damages. In liberals' most lurid fantasies, McCarthy never authored such a libelous document. He never arranged for the postmaster to spy on the private mail of a fellow senator. He never threatened to expose a man's alcoholism. He was never compelled to pay damages for defaming someone. And yet, to this day, historians dismiss the unparalleled assaults on McCarthy with such delusional remarks as, "Joe was not the only one who could play rough." The only one? He may be the only one who didn't. McCarthy came up with a few witty nicknames for his colleagues, and they acted as if he had burned their houses to the ground. He didn't libel them, spy on them, or gay-bait them. All that was done to him. Even McCarthy's exemplary war record was subject to much gleeful jeering. Exempt from the draft as a sitting judge, McCarthy volunteered for the Marines in 1942. He was too old to fly and consequently was an intelligence officer. His principal function was to debrief fighter pilots after bombing runs, famously asking them, "What kind of hell did you give the Japs today?" He volunteered to fly about a dozen combat missions where he came under enemy fire and fired back. He asked for and received a Distinguished Flying Cross. McCarthy's minor embellishments of an estimable war record was infinitesimal compared to that of most politicians. And yet, reporters viciously attack McCarthy's war record as a total fraud. McCarthy's embellishments were nothing compared to the delusional exaggerations of Democrats. One mind-boggling act of courage was Lyndon Johnson's single flight throughout World War II as an observer, for which he was awarded the Silver Star, the third highest combat award. For the rest of his life, Johnson wore what historian David Halberstam called the least deserved and most proudly displayed Silver Star in military history. It was all part of Johnson's roguish charm. The mainstream media was also not much interested in Al Gore's lusty exaggerations of his war record. Throughout the years, Gore had repeatedly provided the media with vivid reminiscences of his combat experiences in Vietnam. In fact, Gore not only never saw combat in Vietnam, but was assigned a bodyguard so that this senator's son would not come in harm's way. Unlike Johnson and Gore, McCarthy actually flew a dozen combat missions, taking enemy fire and firing back. But liberal elites were shocked to the core to discover that McCarthy might have added the slightest bit of color to his military exploits. Historian Oshinsky said McCarthy's boasts were important because they showed a pattern of deception. Excellent point. Patterns are important. The pattern is this. McCarthy engaged in the slightest embellishments of his military record, and then journalists ferociously attacked him with outrageous lies about his admirable military service. The most vivid image people have of McCarthy is of the bow-tied attorney Joseph Welch rebuking him during the Army McCarthy hearings. "Have you no sense of decency, sir, at long last? Have you left no sense of decency?" This is treated as comparable to Henry V's speech at Agincourt, only more inspiring. Leaving no doubt as to Welch's heroic status, reporters in the hearing room erupted in thunderous applause at the conclusion of Welch's emotional response to McCarthy. The viewer can only imagine what horrible cruelty McCarthy had just inflicted on some hapless witness, prompting Welch's cri de coeur. In fact, Welch's speech did not come in response to McCarthy's browbeating of a witness. It was just the opposite. Welch was in the process of browbeating one of McCarthy's assistants, Roy Cohn. McCarthy was not the inquisitor. It was he who was on trial. Indeed, this was the Senate's fourth investigation of McCarthy. In this particular run at him, the Senate was probing whether McCarthy's committee had pressured the Army to grant special privileges to David Shine, a former staff member on McCarthy's committee. Roy Cohn, a brilliant but deeply flawed individual, applied unseemly pressure on the Army to allow Shine to finish his work with the committee, or at least to be given generous weekend passes to do so. A closeted homosexual, Cohn apparently had a mad crush on Shine. McCarthy's troubles with the Army were entirely of his making. Still and all, it was surely one of the lamest acts of influence peddling in all of American history. Among the facts generally omitted from the traditional telling of the Army-McCarthy hearings is that Shine was suddenly drafted in the midst of McCarthy's investigation of the Army's communist infestation problems. Cohn thought Shine's draft was political payback. McCarthy disagreed, annoyed at the suggestion that anything could have deterred him from pursuing his investigation. He simply viewed the entire controversy as asinine. The watchdog press was not much interested in exploring the question of why the Army had drafted Shine, just as the press had showed little interest in why Clinton's IRS audited Paula Jones. In fact, the Army's motives may have been pure, but Shine's draft was absolutely political. It came about only as a result of the vigorous lobbying efforts of a ferociously anti-McCarthy journalist, Drew Pearson. When Shine was first drafted, he received a deferment because of a slipped disc. His back had since healed, something the draft board would likely have overlooked, but for Pearson's frenetic letter-writing campaign to the Army, demanding a review of Shine's deferment. By all accounts, Shine was perfectly happy to be drafted, and McCarthy showed no interest in relieving him of his duty. McCarthy humored Cohn, while quietly confiding in the Secretary of the Army, Robert Stevens, "You can send Shine to Korea for all I care." He said, "Shine's a good boy, but there's nothing indispensable about him." McCarthy even laughed with Stevens about Cohn's machinations, saying Cohn thinks David should be a general and work from the penthouse of the Waldorf. Despite enormous pressure to fire Cohn when details of his lobbying the army came out, McCarthy refused. He was fiercely, perhaps suicidally, loyal to Cohn, whom McCarthy did see as indispensable. In any event, as Soviet spies wormed their way into the government, the U.S. Senate decided to investigate the pressing matter of whether McCarthy's committee had pressured the army to give Private David Shine a fur-lined hood, or allowed him to often ride in the cab of army trucks. At one point, McCarthy said in exasperation, "Don't you think this is a little ridiculous? Is my committee being charged with pressuring the army to give David Shine a fur-lined cap?" Admittedly, McCarthy was not at his best during the Army-McCarthy hearings. He had been under relentless attacks from the press for 4 solid years. He began drinking more than usual during the hearings, often working in his office all night sipping straight vodka. Still, he was better than his adversaries. Confident that the media would portray them as eloquent and reasonable no matter what they did, the Democrats behaved like animals, sneering, interrupting, and catcalling McCarthy throughout the hearings. McCarthy could not finish a sentence without being interrupted by obstructionist Democrats. The incessant attacks would have tried Mother Teresa's patience. But McCarthy had grown accustomed to liberal scolds and responded with his usual humor. Welch's "Have You No Decency" oration came at the conclusion of his 2-hour harangue of Roy Cohn. With staggering condescension, Welch sarcastically asked Cohn to give him the names of all communists loose today. He taunted Cohn relentlessly with exaggerated horror. "Whenever you learn of one from now on, Mr. Cohn, I beg of you, will you tell somebody about them quick?" He squealed with mock alarm. "I don't want the sun to go down while they're still in there if we can get them out." In the face of Welch's sarcasm, Cohn replied to every sneer with immense politeness, nearly stirring him to death. "Yes, sir. I will try, sir." Welch was playing to the peanut gallery. The reporters, the Democrats, and Welch were having a rip-roaring good laugh at the notion of communists in government. Stalin's show trials must have had them in stitches. It was after hours of Welch's gay-baiting, mocking attack on McCarthy's assistant that McCarthy stepped in with a knockout punch. He said that, in light of the fact that Mr. Welch had such terror and such a great desire to know where anyone is located who may be serving the communist cause, "We should just call to your attention the fact that you're Mr. Fisher, who is still in your law firm today, whom you asked to have down here today looking over the secret and classified material, is a member of an organization not named by me, but named by the Attorney General. I quote this verbatim as the legal bulwark of the Communist Party. He belonged to that for a sizable number of years, according to his own admission, and he belonged to it long after it had been exposed as the legal arm of the Communist Party." Welch had walked right into it. "You want to know where the communists are? In your law firm, Mr. Welch." McCarthy continued, "I've hesitated bringing that up, but I've been rather bored with your phony request to Mr. Cohn here that he personally get every communist out of government before sundown. Therefore, we will give you information about the young man in your own organization." It was a devastating rejoinder to Welch's theatrics. Welch responded the way liberals always do when they have been outfoxed. He cried. Slowly, deliberately, and with glistening eyes, Welch said, "Until this moment, Senator, I think I have never really gauged your cruelty or your recklessness." Boo-hoo-hoo. He also made the singularly unhelpful point that Fisher had attended Harvard Law School, not exactly an unheard-of training ground for communists. Welch admitted that, yes, he had invited Fisher to work for the committee, but when he found out about the Lawyers Guild, he sent him back to Boston. Welch said he told Fisher that if his work for the Lawyers Guild were ever revealed, it would just hurt like the dickens. Oddly, for a man who had hoped to spare Fisher that pain, Welch had already told the whole story to the New York Times. Telling the New York Times of Fisher's communist past proved an ineffective method of keeping it quiet. 2 months earlier, the newspaper of record had run a photo of Fisher, along with the story, quote, Mr. Welch today confirmed news reports that he had relieved from duty his original second assistant, Frederick G. Fisher, Jr., of his own Boston law office because of admitted previous membership in the National Lawyers Guild, referred to by Herbert Brownell, Jr., the Attorney General, as the legal mouthpiece of the Communist Party. Years later, in its passion for accuracy, the New York Times would falsely state that it was McCarthy who had branded the Lawyers Guild the legal bulwark of the Communist Party. When McCarthy had the temerity to mention this deeply personal and private fact, recently published in the New York Times, Welch was shocked to the core. He scolded McCarthy. "Little did I dream you could be so reckless and cruel as to do an injury to that lad." A towering monument of wounded indignation, Welch said he could not forgive McCarthy. "If it were in my power to forgive you for your reckless cruelty, I will do so. I like to think I am a gentleman, but your forgiveness will have to come from someone other than me." An astonished McCarthy responded to Welch's cruel and reckless speech by noting that it was Welch who had just been baiting Mr. Cohn here for hours. Welch quickly brushed aside his venomous attacks on Cohn, saying to him, "I meant to do you no injury, sir. Let's move on." Then he returned with gusto to sobbing about Fisher, launching the line about which songs will be sung for generations to come. "Let us not assassinate this lad further, Senator. You have done enough. Have you no sense of decency, sir, at long last? Have you left no sense of decency?" This is usually when the trumpets blare and the curtain closes. In fact, the hearing continued. By now, McCarthy was completely perplexed. Raising a topic of precisely zero interest to liberals, he said, "If I say anything which is not the truth, then I would like to know about it." The truth was immaterial. Welch was going for an Academy Award. From start to finish, the press gallery performed the same function as the bovine in-studio audiences for political talk shows. They cheered at every insult thrown at McCarthy, no matter how stupid or humorless. McCarthy's unfailingly witty riposts were met with stone silence or womanly gasps of horror from the peanut gallery. Welch's performance was still not complete. In the hallway outside the hearing room, he walked a gauntlet of cameras, managing to evoke a few fresh tears for each one. Finally, when Welch had rounded a corner and was out of sight of the press, he perked up and chipperly asked an assistant, "Well, how did it go?" Precisely 10 seconds after Welch stopped crying about the permanent scar left by Fisher's association with the Lawyers Guild, liberals reverted to calling the Lawyers Guild a group of idealists who believed in civil rights. In a shocking development, despite Welch's predictions of utter ruin, Fisher somehow survived the permanent scar of his association with the National Lawyers Guild. On the occasion of Fisher's death, the New York Times described the horror and suffering that befell Fisher. Despite Mr. Welch's dire predictions, Fisher went on to become a partner at Boston's prestigious Hale & Dorr and president of the Massachusetts Bar Association. And he got a nice obituary in the New York Times. Welch's performance at the Army-McCarthy hearings is the essence of liberal argumentation. Welch would say something vicious, McCarthy would reply, and Welch would start crying. This is why no woman worth her salt ever loses an argument. They start crying, making it unmanly to pursue your victory. With the exception of Senator Stuart Symington, whom McCarthy repeatedly referred to as an alleged man, McCarthy made the mistake of assuming he was dealing with men, not little girls. As he left the hearing room, McCarthy kept asking everyone around him, "What did I do?" The press was exultant, thrilled that Welch had gotten the better of McCarthy, or at least he would in their